Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Oh, Miles here.
Welcome, witches and wizards. Owlpost is freshly delivered this week. I am just one of the hosts, your surveyor of all that is Potter, Matt Rushing, and with me, as she is always, the wonderful, the talented, the magnificent, Treya Kaufman.
Hello. I feel like whenever we welcome witches and wizards, I feel like we need like a fangirl scream, like, after that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like in Moana, where he's like, Moana, you're so awesome. Yeah, we should do that. We should have it like, Treya, you're so awesome. Yeah, that'd be great. Oh, man, that'd be hilarious. Anyway, nobody cares about that. No, I'm so excited to be here. We only have 3 chapters left in this book, and it's just super crazy to think that we are so close to being done with the Philosopher's Stone. And so we're going to be heading into the Forbidden Forest with the kids tonight in Hagrid. But before we do that, just want to remind you of a few things that you can do to help out the show, especially if you've just found us. You know, a perfect place to find us is on iTunes. And if you review us and rate us on iTunes, it really does help out the show. It helps more people find us. So the more written ratings and reviews that we get, the better. And we wanted to thank a new reviewer. We got a new review. Did you know that, Treya?
I didn't. And I wish you all could see my face right now.
It's she's got a huge smile. It's awesome. But Spock787 gave us a review, and they said it's a great podcast, 5 stars, and they said that you can really tell that the hosts love the series.
It's true, we do.
Yeah, a little bit. Okay, I'm obsessed. I mean, I only have like 3 different copies of each book in the series. That's not excessive, is it?
I mean, I only shared my love of Harry Potter and my podcast here with Matthew during an interview. So, I mean, that's how passionate we are.
That's very true. So, yes, follow their lead. Give us a star rating and review there on iTunes. But, of course, you can find us on any podcatcher, pretty much any network out there. We're all over the place. You can find us on Twitter at @JoinNerdParty. We are also on the Nerd Party Network at thenerdparty.com, where you can find our show. And on Facebook, it's a great way to interact with us because we post our shows and stuff. So you can comment there, and Dre and I will comment back. And that's at facebook.com/thenerdparty. So we'd love to have some feedback from you guys about what you're thinking about the shows and that kind of stuff. It's great to talk to you. And we really do appreciate all the reviews. It's a lot of Potter love going around right now. We love it. Because we love Potter love.
You got Potter hearts going on right now, guys.
Yeah, that sounds Potter hearts. It kind of sounds like an 80s hair band ballad, you know? Potter hearts!
We need Heart to sing this.
Oh, yes, that would be awesome. I'm totally picturing that right now. Anyway, okay, focus on the show where we're going to talk about the Forbidden Forest. And you know, this one starts kind of right where we left off. And one of the first things is Harry's thinking in his brain how stupid he was, as we thought, to forget the cloak.
I know. I was so excited. I was like, oh, my God, that was my thought, too. Oh, my God. We're like the same person. I got way too excited, like, and right away about it. It was a little embarrassing. But
yeah, it was nice because you can tell. And that's one thing that I like that Rowling does here with the series is that for the most part, the kids are smart, you know, and Harry immediately realizes the mistake he made, because obviously if he had had the cloak on with him and Hermione, they wouldn't have gotten caught. But, you know, it also is an interesting thing because you realize just how much you don't want to piss off McGonagall.
Oh, my God, she's terrifying.
She is terrifying, even in a tartan robe. Maybe yeah. That's what makes her more terrifying.
Well, not only, I don't know, sometimes I feel like it's not so much that she makes the kids smart as she makes them logical. Like, their thought process is logical. The logical thing is to say, like, oh, crap, well, if mm-hmm. I hadn't forgot that, then, like, I wouldn't be in this boat, because for me, smart would be like, he would have come up with an excuse like on the spot to save their butts, which he didn't, which is fine.
Right.
But that just the basic logic of, oh crap, is something I think everybody can relate to, whether you're smart or dumb or whatever.
No, absolutely. And I think it's so funny because she doesn't really let them talk all that much. She just kind of infers what she thinks happened, which is she feels like they were just trying to set up Malfoy, told him about this dragon, and that they were watching him get caught. And then, of course, they get caught. But I love this whole little tiny scene, because as she's kind of like ranting at them, Harry catches Neville's eye. And she says it this beautifully, that to try and tell him without words that it wasn't true, that he's not blaming Neville, right, and because of everything that Ghana was saying. And I just really love that Harry internally is thinking about the cost to Neville to go out into the castle at night to warn them that Malfoy's coming.
Yeah.
And it really forges something I think is so important here. And again, I think this is one of the things you kind of miss in the movie, just how much these even side characters like Neville are getting growth opportunities. And so that the end, when it will happen, will mean so much more. And this is massive, because this is also where, you know, they lose Gryffindor 150 points.
That's a lot of points.
It's a lot. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty awful. And so they really do hurt Gryffindor. And this is also a really interesting point for Harry, because, you know, the kids have been so focused on trying to solve this mystery. And Harry swears off meddling in things that aren't his business. And he actually does a pretty good job of it in this chapter, for the most part. Like, he's like, no. Like, you can see him like put his hands over his ears when things come up. Earmuffs.
He does. He tries really hard. Not that he works out so well, but he tries really hard.
Well, it's almost like the galaxy or the universe or fate or
the
God
stars,
or whatever, the stars, that they are against him, because he keeps like running into things he shouldn't see, like Quirrell coming out of a classroom basically almost crying and realizing that it had to be Snape making him this happen, because he hears this whole conversation. And of course, he's really kind of only hearing one side of it. And his immediate reaction is that, well, great, Quirrell gave up the way to get to the stone. We're screwed.
Aw, crap.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and this is what was interesting, too, because, you know, a lot of times you kind of forget, but Hermione actually says, like, we just go to Dumbledore. That's what we do. That's how we make this situation better.
I love that she just is that voice of logic. Like, let's not get ourselves in trouble. Let's go tell an adult. And everyone's like, no, that's not
well,
what we
and
do.
Exactly. And then what's funny is the logic that Harry kind of puts back on him is like, but we don't have any proof of anything. Like, we're just stringing together all of these ideas and nobody's going to back us up. Quirrell's not going to back us up. Snape's going to say he doesn't know. And I mean, it's so interesting, the two different sides of logic and how both of their logic is right.
Yeah. Go tell an adult, because she trusts the system. It's just one of those times where, like, Hermione is Hermione, right? She trusts the system. She trusts the adults. And then Ron and Harry are like, no, this isn't what you do. Like, that's not how this works. I don't trust the system. I don't trust that this is going to work out the right way. And you're like, well, that all sucked. I guess none of that's a good option.
Well, and I do like, too, that Harry's like, and don't forget, we're not supposed to know about the stone and Fluffy. That'll take a lot of explaining.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. I mean, it's that same question you kind of always ask yourself when you're watching like a horror movie or something like that. Like, why didn't you call the police? Like, why didn't you tell an adult? And then they like logic through like the fact why they didn't do it. And you're like, oh, I guess
no,
that's okay.
It is nice. It is really nice. And it's a, It's an interesting thing because we go on detention, and their detention, this is the strangest detention ever.
I think I agree with Malfoy in that if any parents found out, they'd probably not be too happy about it.
Well, yeah, and I thought it was really interesting because they have him and Malfoy and Hagrid have this whole conversation, and Hagrid's like, what would lines do for anything? You're going to be useful. That's how you're going to get due detention. And we find out that a unicorn has been hurt and or maybe killed in the forest. And that's what we're searching for. And yeah, it is a very interesting thing to bring kids on this hunt for a killer on the loose that maybe have brought down a unicorn.
Yeah.
But
it's a little strange, but I mean, who can complain based on some of the punishments we get a little later on?
Well, that's very true. And it is interesting, too, because it also brings up this whole aspect of Malfoy throwing at Hagrid. You know, this is servant stuff, not for students to do. And you get that whole class kind of warfare thing.
Yeah.
It's very prevalent and more so in a British system because you still have the structures of class in some ways.
That is, a lot stronger there.
But, to say bring it to the U.S., it would kind of be like saying, that's like minimum wage job stuff. I mean, come on. It's really the same kind of attitude. And so they end up going in to the forest, and I think it feels even creepier here than it even does in the movie. I mean, there's just something about the way she describes it all, and you know, the fact that you see this unicorn blood all over the place, and they catch a glimpse a few times of something, and they keep asking if it's a werewolf. Which I like, because again, you're bringing that kind of thing
in. Come back around to that.
Yeah. It's going to come back around. And this is also one of those aspects where, as we're in the forest, she uses this as an opportunity to really explore the depths of the wizarding world in some pretty surprising ways. Because I didn't expect when I first read this book for us to run into centaurs in the forest, you know?
It's true. And it's one of the things that they leave out of the movie for, like, the entire movie. I don't think they ever come in.
No, there's one centaur that saves in its friends.
Yeah.
But there isn't the other two. You never run into Ronan.
Or Bane.
And, yeah, no, I think...
Well, and we don't ever see them again, and they in the actual series, they're kind of a big part of the series.
Yeah, you don't see them until, what is it, 5, when they take Umbridge into the...
Well, no, we see him again because we meet Ferenz again, because he works with Trelawney.
Yes, in book 6, isn't it?
I don't know, but we all...
I don't remember 6.
If we see him again in this book, or we see him again... I think we see him again in this book. Because, spoilers, we see him beaten for breaking.
Oh, you're right.
The rules that they have, like their centaur rules of not disobeying the planets or whatever.
Yep. You're absolutely right.
I feel like it's either right at the end of this book or right at the beginning of or sometime in the next one. It's more that we see the punishment, like we learn a little bit more about their sort of internal structure.
You learn a lot about their culture just from the conversations that they have. Because
small interaction here.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that the centaurs are stargazers, and this whole idea of being very future forward looking, always looking to the stars, always reading the stars. And I love how you also get Hermione's kind of, you know... Well, that's kind of a wobbly piece of magic, you know. It's not really, but the way, and I think there's a big difference too, because she sets up a distinction later on in the series between like Trelawney and somebody like the centaurs, who seem to be much better at their job as fortune tellers and looking to the future with the stars. So, yes, I think that's something that's really, I really like that we get that here.
I think it was, okay, so they couldn't have added this in to the movie without including Neville in this whole sort of ordeal. Because I think in the movie, it's Ron, Harry, and Hermione.
Yes, yep.
And I had completely forgotten about it, and it made me chuckle so much. When we got to the part where they're in the forest, and they split up into groups, and Malfoy and Neville go one way with Fang, and Harry, Hermione, and Hagrid go the other way. And you see the red sparks shoot up, which we learn later about, but apparently we also learned about here, which I had forgotten. But you learn that it's because Malfoy jumped up and scared Neville from behind.
Yes.
Like, I had completely forgotten about that part, and it cracked me up.
Yeah, and it just, what it does is it really continues that, like, you just, Malfoy.
You just
what
hate little, that guy.
Just, he's just a little turd, you know? Like, he just is. And, well, and this is where you kind of get it where it's more like the movie, where it's Harry and Malfoy. And all of the sudden, it just feels like Harry's scar is on fire. Like, he kind of feels like he's dying almost. And he doesn't even kind of really realize what's happened until he finds himself on the back of a centaur and its friends who saved him.
Yeah.
I love the whole conversation that he and Ferenz has, because Ferenz doesn't seem to have a problem with telling this kid exactly kind of what's going on. And yeah, like, you shouldn't be here.
Or at least giving him the pieces to figure it out himself.
Yes. Yes. Well, and the whole idea of, like, look, this is not a safe place for you. And it gives you that sense that the centaurs do kind of know what's going on around the castle and what's happening. They know, they understand that this aberration of Voldemort is back. He doesn't give them quite that one for one, but I just think it's a really fantastic thing that just somebody's kind of leveling with Harry just a little bit.
Yeah.
About, like, you're in danger, kid. You should get out of here.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's probably the first time anyone's actually sort of done that for him.
No, absolutely. Because, I mean, nobody else is doing it here. I mean, Hagrid's kind of the closest that's come to telling him some of that stuff, you know, but they've kind of had to trick it out of him. But, you know, the whole conversation with Ferenz is, if you drink unicorn blood, if you kill a unicorn, it'll keep you alive, even if you're an inch from death. And the whole conversation leads to, can you not think of anyone who might want to have that happen? And Harry's smart enough to put those two pieces together.
Yeah.
And it's I think back to reading it the first time, and it's that kind of really big eye-opening thing. Oh, man. The guy that killed Harry, or tried to kill Harry, and killed his parents. That's the dude that's back, and now you put all the pieces together because Harry realizes he's after the stone, because that's what will bring him fully back, and that's not good.
That doesn't sound like a good idea.
No, not at all. And I love that Harry goes back and is talking with Ron and Hermione, and they're talking all this through, and he keeps saying Voldemort's name because he doesn't care.
And he's like a honey badger. He doesn't understand.
Yeah. Honey badgers don't care. Harry don't care. He'll call him what he wants. You know? Harry Potter don't give a...
Sorry, the honey badger thing really got to me.
Yeah. Well, I always think of the fact that you know, everybody thinks Hufflepuffs are all sweet and innocent and whatnot, but you know, honey badger, that's really what their mascot is.
They are so vicious.
They can be if you come after their friends. Honey badger don't care.
Or unicorns. They don't care.
Exactly. Exactly. But I love this whole thing is that, you know, they're having this discussion. The kids are trying to figure out, okay, what do we do about this? And this is also the point in which Hermione is pretty frightened, but she reminds them, look, you know, Harry, everybody says Dumbledore is the only one that you know who feared. And if Dumbledore's around, we're going to be okay. And then this is where she's also does her Hermione thing, which is, and I mean, you know, fortune telling, it's kind of imprecise as a form of magic, you know, so maybe we don't trust them so much. And I just love how all of Hermione's knowledge in her brain is trying to come together to kind of disprove what Harry's saying, because she didn't like what he's saying.
Right. Well, I think it's interesting later on her approach to like how we really see her disdain for this, like kind of come out for this whole not category. What do teachers teach?
Subject.
Subject. Thank you. That's exactly what I'm looking for. It's interesting how we see later on, too, as it progresses, how much her disdain for this subject comes out and how she just does not find their this subject to have like any value whatsoever.
Yeah, no, it is funny because you have that really start here and it'll be a theme that keeps going.
It especially gets to be a big one, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean specifically throughout the third book and onward. But yes, it's funny though because, spoiler alert, it is also going to be something that which she'll accept more and more. But because of her interactions with Harry and what Harry learns about himself and everything. So it becomes something she becomes a little bit more comfortable with, but
still not.
I think it's one of those things that happens, but it's really because of where she is. And so
I still feel like to an extent she doesn't really buy it. Like she doesn't have a better explanation for it in the moment, but that doesn't mean that she necessarily buys into it.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and this is something that I wanted to ask you about, because the very end, you know, Harry finds his invisibility cloak underneath his sheets.
Which
with a
makes
note.
Me so happy, by the way. Yeah. I was so happy when I read that part again. I was like, because the whole time I'm like, how is he going to get it back?
But it says, you know, just in case. And so I wanted to ask you this. You know, we talked about, you know, these kids doing this thing and you know, being the main protagonist, obviously, and being in these situations. But I think that this is pretty clear and conclusive evidence that
someone's enabling them.
Dumbledore is enabling Harry.
So I was curious. I would love to know if anybody has a burning desire to share. If the first time you read this book, you knew that it was Dumbledore giving them the cloak. Like, I would love to know if anyone figured that out kind of on their own. Like at this point, or if it took a little longer and getting into things a little bit more to sort of figure it out. I'm trying to remember. I cannot remember if I did. I think at this point I still had no idea. But it does warm my heart that Dumbledore basically enables them the whole book, like the entire time. They do something wrong. He finds himself sitting in front of the mirror and it's all right. We'll just move the mirror. Like, it's just so interesting how forgiving and understanding Dumbledore is to these kids. And it just shows how much of an impact a great teacher and mentor can really have on a group. So for me, I thought it was great that he gave him the cloak back. And I wonder if Harry has figured it out at this point. And I think it really goes to drive home that point we learn in the seventh book that I won't say, so I don't ruin it for people who haven't gotten that far, because it's kind of not in the movie. So it's not something I actually want to ruin. But it's I don't know. I think it's such an interesting part that she starts so early and weaves out through the book so long. It's probably my favorite element of the whole book is the invisibility cloak.
What it does is you're saying it starts this foundation that Dumbledore is aware of what's happening in the school. He's aware of who's back, and he's also aware in the end of really the only one who has an opportunity to stop who's back.
Yeah. It shows that he sort of knows the story before the rest of us, and that it's already in motion, and he thinks that he is doing what's right.
Right. No, exactly. And he's doing that thing that a great like coach or teacher does, is that puts the student out there or the player out there and makes them learn on the fly, you know, makes them learn by doing. And that's something that is going to come up specifically, say, in book five, when Harry's able to say, look, I didn't know I was doing half the time, you know, but it's the ability to learn under pressure, which allows natural talent and inclinations to come out. And Harry has those, and he's only able to do those things is because Dumbledore trusts him enough to do it. But it also is a thing that is interesting because Dumbledore's in that bind of realizing that he kind of doesn't have a better choice.
It's true. It's true. Yeah. He doesn't really feel like he has a choice. I think, isn't it, we find out that he is one of the few people who knows what the prophecy is. And I think he, as we talk a little bit later about sort of self-fulfilling prophecies, particularly as it pertains to like Harry and Neville and Voldemort, I think we have to give a little bit of, I guess, culpability to Dumbledore in that sense too, in helping to manifest that prediction so that it's fulfilled, if you will. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really interesting how early on all of this starts and how you don't realize what is happening until probably book five. I mean, you really start to understand what is going on.
No, absolutely. And I think it's interesting too, because at this point, and even then, and it's not till the very end that I think Harry understands just how much Dumbledore trusts him.
Yeah.
I mean, Dumbledore is placing all of his eggs in one basket. That's the Harry basket, right? And he is trusting this child to be able to figure these things out. And I think it's obviously a wonderful story in the sense that, you know, Rowling has been able to kind of tap into that hero's journey kind of thing, have the old wizened man who's there to help train him and everything. But it's also unconventional in the sense that Dumbledore isn't face to face with Harry, especially like in this book and the next book, until more towards the end of the story, not, you know, kind of throughout the story. And so it creates a different dynamic. And I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, for myself, I know that I didn't figure out the invisibility cloak until Dumbledore said it at the end, you know, and that she kind of keeps that part hidden just to how important he's going to be, Dumbledore specifically, the character, to Harry later on. So I think it's a masterful job. And it's creating a really rich story. And what's so fun is to be back here at the beginning and be able to see the whole puzzle, you know?
All her little webs that she weaves.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it's really great. I mean, it's really interesting to think about it from that perspective where you're thinking about kind of Dumbledore having to put all his eggs in this 11-year-old's mm-hmm. basket. Like, I don't know that I would be brave enough to do that. Let's be honest. I think it's a brave and kind of a risky move. And I think that's part of why he keeps it so quiet. And that's why a lot of the other teachers don't know what's going on and things like that. Mm-hmm. Not just because he doesn't know who to trust, because I feel like he does know, but it's because he knows that right. He will strongly be judged as this is wrong for putting Harry and the other kids in these situations. But he is taking a risk and hoping that nothing comes back to bite him and that everything sort of works out and that he can step in and control the situation when he needs to. And that's tough.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. Well, it's a great chapter, and it really sets us up for what we're going to get with the last two chapters. And I'm so excited to be diving into those soon and finishing up this book. I mean, I can't believe we're almost here. So
I know. It feels like just yesterday we started.
Yeah, it does. Well, I'm super excited. And, you know, Drea, if anybody wants to kind of catch up with you online and talk a little bit more Harry Potter, where can they find you and do that?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at PCFchick or on Instagram at Drea Kaufman, and it's COFFMAN. And usually I'm chatting with Matthew on one of the two.
Which you are, and I'm so glad that we get to do that so much, especially about Harry Potter. And if you would like to chat with me as well, I'm on Twitter, as we were just talking about, at MattRushing02. I'm also here on the network doing another show about Star Wars with my good friend John Mills, and it's really a blast. We have such a good time talking about Star Wars each and every week on Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast, so please check us out over there. You're going to love it. We're on iTunes, of course. You can also find me on the Trek FM network, where I am doing a show called The 602 Club. It is our general geek show. We talk about all the fandoms we love, from Harry Potter, Marvel, DC, Star Wars, everything possible under the sun. We try to fit in as much as we can. And we also have Star Wars The 602 Club collection specifically there on iTunes as well. So both of those feeds are there on iTunes, and doing The Orb with Chris Jones, where we're talking about Deep Space Nine. Well, I hope you'll check all of those out, and thank you so much for checking your Owlpost.
Mischief managed.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.